I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear William Pepper's speech from our March 26th, 2011 conference called Investigate Building 7. And then I'm going to share with you some information about the Toronto hearings coming up on the 10th anniversary this September. Dr. Pepper's job at the conference was to introduce the three researchers, Graham McQueen, Kevin Ryan, and Tony Zambodi. Today you'll just hear his opening remarks before he introduced each speaker. Damon Bean, who created the website ct911truth.org, introduced Dr. Pepper at the conference, so you'll also hear that at the beginning here. So here he is, Damon Bean, followed by William Pepper.
But I'm up here to introduce Dr. William Pepper. Dr. Pepper is an English barrister and American attorney focusing on international human rights. He has worked with and was a friend of Martin Luther King during the last year of Dr. King's life. Martin had read articles of Vietnam where William Pepper had been a journalist and asked to meet with him. Bill showed him from his photo essays in the 1967 Ramparts. When Martin saw that in the photos, he wept and asked Bill Pepper to work closely with him as Dr. King turned hard against the war. 9 years after the assassination, family and friends of Dr. King asked Bill Pepper to interrogate James Earl Ray. He did in 1978. And 10 years later, after becoming convinced that Ray was an unknown patsy, agreed to represent him. 2 books and an unscripted television trial later, and having been denied by the Sixth Circuit and then certified by the Supreme Court, Ray died in custody. Bill Pepper continued with a civil trial in Memphis in which he represented the family of Martin Luther King. The trial lasted for 30 days with the questioning of over 70 witnesses exonerating Ray and setting out how Dr. King was killed. The jury took just 59 minutes to so rule and lay blame on agents of the U.S., state, and local governments. A similar scenario followed as Bill Pepper examined the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. As it turns out, Bill had been the citizen chairman for Robert F. Kennedy's 1963 New York Senate campaign. As his investigation of RFK's assassination progressed, new evidence of Sirhan's actual innocence emerged that was even stronger than the evidence that he had presented in the Martin Luther King case. Bill has now become lead counsel for Sirhan Sirhan. Bill Pepper also convened the Seminar on International Human Rights at Oxford University for 2 years and is currently the expert to the Magistrates Court in Spain on universal jurisdiction, with an opinion before the court urging the prosecution of members of the Bush administration for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and violations of the Torture Convention. Bill has advised a number of 9/11 victim families, has admired the efforts and good work of many 9/11 researchers, and has long advocated the necessity of an independent investigation in order for the truth to see the light of day. To this end, Bill Pepper played an active role as legal advisor to the NYC Can Ballot Initiative, a 9/11 family member-supported campaign for a new New York City investigation of the 9/11 attacks. With that, ladies and gentlemen, it's my great honor to introduce Dr. William Pepper.
Thank you for that. I have a very minor role here today, and I primarily want to pay tribute and recognize the efforts of the family of victims of 9/11. I want to pay tribute to the New York group that have worked so hard to push this Building 7 campaign forward. Ted Walter and Dennis McMahon and that entire group down there. And I want to compliment and express my appreciation personally to the group here, who once again have stirred the pot and caused this important issue to be put into the limelight, brought forward in a very important and forceful way. My role really here is to introduce primary researchers, people who have really done the work on this case. I've not done any research. I've read their work. I've been impressed with all of the work of Graham and Kevin and Tony, and from the outset with the work of David Ray Griffin, who has become a friend. It's these individuals and their efforts that are making a difference at this point in time. The task will always be how to survive, how to cause the truth that they espouse over this terrible tragedy to survive all of our passing, and not just go into the dustbin of history, but to somehow bring forth a significant proceeding somewhere in this land, so that in fact the truth can be brought out and given credibility under oath. And that really is the task, and you'll see the importance of it as you see the depth of the work that they've done, which is unknown throughout America, totally unknown. Now, because Damon has mentioned the prosecution in Spain, which has lingered now for so long, I appeared before Judge Garzon, must be now nearly a year ago, Officer Garzon, and testified in his court, and he accepted the opinion. And Judge Garzon, as some of you know, no doubt, was the man who went after Pinochet. Spain tried to have him extradited from the United Kingdom. So he's a man of enormous courage. The United States government under the Obama administration has done everything it can do to stop the Spanish court from investigating and prosecuting individuals who were responsible for the torture and the criminal acts against 7 Spanish nationals. On that basis, Spain does have jurisdiction. The Spanish High Court has agreed. Unfortunately, Judge Garzon was taken off the case. All of the pressures, the political pressures, permeated the Supreme Court. They found a reason to lay charges against him, and so he has been removed from that case. But Pablo Ruiz, a much less publicly known judge, but an independent magistrate under the civil code system, an independent magistrate is not politically accountable to anyone. And he has decided to go forward, and he is going to investigate this crime. He's starting with a subpoena to be issued to Jeffrey Miller, who was, as you know, was in charge of Guantanamo. It's an aftermath of 9/11. And that would be the tip of the iceberg. From there, the investigation will proceed in a timely fashion. So, this 9/11 catastrophe, and I see from the banner down there, certainly was the most earth-shaking, outstanding event of our time. When you look at the other areas of criminality by public officials and by the state, going back in our history, very far back in our history, this one stands alone for the power and the effect that it had, not only upon this republic, but upon the entire world. Everything changed after 9/11. In my view, and I think the view of many, this republic became a rogue state after 9/11. There were no rule of law anymore. There were no boundaries. They could kidnap. They could torture. They could kill. They could use extraordinary rendition to pick people up off a street and have them sent to Egypt, or Syria, or Morocco. Oh yes, or even to Eastern Europe, where the torturing would be done by surrogates. They would engage in 2 wars. One, as you know, had nothing to do whatsoever with 9/11. That was the illegal war against Iraq. The second one in Afghanistan had the portent of having something to do, because forces that we had supported, trained, armed, financed, decided that they were going to take control of their country and espouse a degree of fundamental Islam that was unpalatable. So there was no stopping the stretch of the Republic as it became a rogue state. And everyone in this room, everyone in every citizen is susceptible. You're susceptible to being even ordered to be killed, as you know. That President Obama has given those instructions for the first time, even though Americans and American officials and intelligence agencies have done this forever. Now it has become an official part of American policy. So what we're up against here, and the rock that's being pushed up this enormous hill, is a major challenge of our lifetime. It must be the challenge that we continue in the interest of our children and grandchildren. So there's no mistake about it. The work that people like Graham, Kevin, and Tony are doing has to go on. It has to be absorbed, and it has to permeate the entirety of this land. I tend to find more receptivity in Europe than I do in the United States about the truth. Maybe because the Europeans tend to be, over the centuries, much more politically skeptical and suspicious of their rulers. But nevertheless, they're there. European public officials have spoken out. European intelligence officials have spoken out at various times and relayed a truth. A major problem here with respect to the work of these good researchers and yourselves, and indeed all of us, is the control of mainstream media. The control of the corporate media is virtually complete at this point in time, and it's very, very difficult to overcome that control. Sadly, even the left has its own gatekeepers, and those gatekeepers on the left are also well known to those of you who tried to get this story told. So it's not going to be an easy task to overcome the dark night of silence that surrounds this issue. The threats that go to individuals who were eyewitnesses, who did see things, and who are afraid of the loss of their pensions, or even their lives, or the lives of their families. So it's not going to be an easy struggle, and I just simply applaud again all of you who continue it and are willing to continue to wage the struggle. Now here today, we're going to hear the critical work of three people, and we're going to look at it when they finish speaking in terms of what could be presented possibly in a court of law, so that if one takes the combined works of research and scholarship of these people to a prosecutor, to a district attorney, one could argue convincingly that, look, this is hard evidence. This would be admissible for a grand jury. And we're going to take that kind of legalistic look. I mean, admittedly, it'll be in summary fashion. But we're going to take that kind of legalistic look at some of the work to see what actually has gone on and what could be brought there. I believe at some point in time, with an adequate record that's compiled, and this may have to be done through a civil action that, in my view, is a very carefully planned civil action, not the one that happened in Washington that my dear friends of Motley Rice brought, but another very carefully studied civil action so that there is a record under oath that has the credibility that contains the work of these people. And that's what I think we'll have to do. When that is done, and that will be done eventually, it's a question always of money. When that is done, I find it hard to believe that there will not be available in some corner of this republic, some prosecutor, some local district attorney from northern Vermont or western New Hampshire, or somewhere like that, who will say, I'm going to run with this. I've had victims in my jurisdiction. I have families who live here who have lost family members, and I'm convinced, and I'm going to run with this. And it will only take, in my view, one such prosecutor with that kind of courage, and frankly, I think ultimately we're going to find him. But we have to stay the course until then. Well, that's what I'm asking you all to do.
The more one listens to the compendium of facts with respect to Building 7, it becomes clear that there's a sinister work afoot of one sort or another, perhaps very, very detailed and well planned over a considerable period of time. But in order to not just to speculate about that, a legal investigation, a serious investigation, would have to look in depth at all aspects of Building 7. Why Building 7? Why Building 7 when 1 and 2 would likely have accomplished any sinister purpose in terms of the consolidation of power, restriction of liberty and democracy, and give the footloose war on terror an opportunity to proceed throughout the planet? Why add this particular building? I think, and I don't have the answers to that, but I think that an investigation would have to look at who the tenants of Building 7 were. Who were they? Who were all these? Who were the tenants? And what were these various tenant organizations doing? What were they working on? What was the SEC working on at that might have been particularly sensitive? Now that is another whole other area of investigation, which I suggest really would have to be explored legally. I think the mayor of the city of New York would have to be summoned before any serious investigation. Yeah. He located or relocated, as you know, the Office of Emergency Management to Building 7 against all advice. All serious law enforcement, security advice, Giuliani insisted on locating his OEM in that particular building. Why was that done? He also is responsible for coordinating the destruction of all of the most important physical evidence as a result of this entire operation. That is the destruction of all of the steel that came down. Now, Article 205 of the New York Penal Code, Section 205-50, called hindering prosecution, says a person renders criminal assistance when, with intent to prevent, hinder, or delay the discovery or apprehension of a person he knows or believes has committed a crime, he suppresses by any act of concealment, alteration, or destruction any physical evidence which might aid in the discovery or apprehension of such person or in the lodging of a criminal charge against him. There is no doubt, there is no question that the physical evidence whereby the steel, the fallen steel and rubble was taken away by his Department of Design and Construction before any of the FEMA team could get there. His own people were in there removing that physical evidence from the scene of a crime. It's important. They were cutting it up and they were shipping it out. It was gone. That is a criminal act. The mayor of the city of New York. And he, of course, has not been called to task for it and he's not been investigated about this. But that is a legal area that any investigation would have to look at. You know, in the assassination of Martin King, one of the things that struck me over 30 years ago when I first began to look at that was the fact that early the morning following Dr. King's shooting, on the morning of the 5th of April, a public works team under the supervision of Memphis Police Department officers were sent into a brushy area behind the rooming house in which Dr. King was shot. As we later proved, he was actually shot from the bushes itself, not from the building. But they went in there early in the morning and they combed that entire area. They combed it and took it down, and they crew cut it, the bushes that were very, very thick the night before, so that no sniper could ever have been concealed when you see this, what they had done to this, changing the scene of the crime. And the evidence that was removed was removed, and no one knew or would have known about it. So That happened in that situation. What I have found in the assassination of Bob Kennedy was that very soon after he was shot in the pantry and the Los Angeles Police Department took over the investigation, wooden panel doors in the west end of the pantry were removed. They had their eyewitnesses who had seen bullet holes in those doors. Ceiling tiles from the ceiling of the pantry were removed because some bullets had gone up into the ceiling area. So there was great tampering with that scene as well. So it seems it's almost a pattern of necessity in terms of covering up illegal activity and crime, that the scene of the crime be changed and that evidence be removed. So this destruction of evidence is something that has to be looked on very, very seriously, and we're obviously at a disadvantage because we don't have it. Victims' families are at a disadvantage if they were going to sue anyone because they don't have it. And the prosecution is at a disadvantage because it doesn't have that steel that was cut up and that was taken away, and with it whatever forensic information could be disclosed. So I think these are all areas that one has to look at very carefully in terms of an expanded investigation.
And again, you were just listening to the speech given by attorney William Pepper at the March 26, 2011 conference called Investigate Building 7 that was held at the University of Hartford. You can see the video of Dr. Pepper's speech or any of the rest of the conference by going to the website ct911truth.org. And you can also see the full video of the conference on YouTube. And now for the Toronto hearings, I want to share with you something from their website, which is torontohearings.org. And here goes. International hearing on the events of September 11th, 2001. Sponsored by the International Center for 9/11 Studies. September 11, 2011 will be the 10th anniversary of the events in New York and Washington that have played a dramatic role in modern history. These events have provided a pretext for the war on terror that has replaced the Cold War as a global conflict framework within which military invasions and occupations have taken place, as well as violations of international law and human rights, and a widespread assault on civil rights crucial to democracies. Global military spending, which began a sharp downswing after the end of the Cold War, has, with the help of the official account of the 9/11 attacks, risen to Cold War levels and continues to rise. The focus on military solutions to complex human problems has sidetracked humanity at the very moment when international cooperation is most required to address climate change, energy scarcity, and other genuine challenges that humanity faces. In the meantime, skepticism about the official report of the 9/11 attacks by the 9/11 Commission, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, the FBI, and other government or government-approved agencies has risen to high levels in many countries. This skepticism, contrary to what is regularly asserted in mainstream media, has a factual basis and is not merely the result of delusional or conspiratorial thinking. The International Center for 9/11 Studies has decided to sponsor 4 days of citizen hearings in Toronto, Canada, on the 10th anniversary of the events of September 11, 2001. These hearings will not be a mock trial or symbolic tribunal. They will involve the serious, careful, and informed consideration of the best evidence that has been discovered in the 10 years since the 9/11 events occurred. So this sounds like a really great event, and the hearings will be taking place at Ryerson University in Toronto. And if you want more information, I encourage you to check it out at their website, torontohearings.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.